For 7 months after the Second World War began in September 1939, many British people deluded themselves that it might gutter out before there was a bloodbath in the West. On April 5, 1940, while the armed but passive confrontation between the Wehrmacht and Anglo-French forces, which had persisted since the fall of Poland, still prevailed on the Franco-German border, Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain told a Conservative Party meeting, "Hitler has missed the bus." Less than 5 weeks later, however, on May 7th, he addressed the House of Commons to explain the disastrous outcome of Britain's campaign to frustrate the German occupation of Norway. Beginning with a tribute to British troops who had carried out their task with magnificent gallantry, in halting tones he continued, "I hope that we shall not exaggerate the extent or the importance of the check we have received. The withdrawal from southern Norway is not comparable to the withdrawal from Gallipoli. There were no large forces involved, not much more than a single division. Still, I am quite aware that some discouragement has been caused to our friends and that our enemies are crowing. I want to ask honourable members not to form any hasty opinions on the result of the Norwegian campaign so far as it has gone. A minister who shows any sign of confidence is always called complacent. If he fails to do so, he is labelled defeatist. For my part, I try to steer a middle course." Interruption. "Neither raising undue expectations..." Honourable members, "Hitler missed the bus, which are unlikely to be fulfilled, nor making people's flesh creep by painting pictures of unmitigated gloom. A great many times some honourable members have repeated the phrase, 'Hitler missed the bus.'" Honourable members, "You said it. While I retain my complete confidence in our ultimate victory, I do not think that the people of this country yet realize the extent or the imminence of the threat which is impending against us." An honourable member, "We said that 5 years ago." When the debate ended the following night, 33 Tories voted against their own party, and a further 60 abstained. Though Chamberlain retained a parliamentary majority, it was plain that his Conservative government had lost the nation's confidence. This was not merely the consequence of the Norway campaign, but because through 8 fumbling months it had exposed its lack of stomach for war. An all-party coalition was indispensable. Labour would not serve under Chamberlain. Winston Churchill became Britain's Prime Minister following a meeting between himself, Chamberlain, Foreign Secretary Lord Halifax and Tory Chief Whip David Margesson on the afternoon of May 9th, at which Halifax declared his own unsuitability for the post as a member of the House of Lords who would be obliged to delegate direction of the war to Churchill in the Commons. In truth, some expedient could have been adopted to allow the Foreign Secretary to return to the Commons, but Halifax possessed sufficient self-knowledge to recognise that no more than Neville Chamberlain did he possess the stuff of a war leader. While much of the ruling class disliked and mistrusted the new Premier, he was the overwhelming choice of the British people. With remarkably sure instinct, they perceived that if they must wage war, the leadership of a warrior was needed. David Reynolds has observed that when the Gallipoli campaign failed in 1915, many people wished to blame Churchill, then, as in 1940, First Lord of the Admiralty, while after Norway, nobody did. "It was a marvel," Churchill wrote in an unpublished draft of his war memoirs. "I really do not know how I survived and maintained my position in public esteem while all the blame was thrown on poor Mr. Chamberlain." He may also have perceived his own good fortune in not having achieved the highest office in earlier years, or even in the earlier months of the war. Had he done so, It is likely that by May 1940 his country would have tired of the excesses which he would surely have committed, while being no more capable than Chamberlain of stemming the tide of fate on the continent. Back in 1935, Stanley Baldwin explained to a friend his unwillingness to appoint Churchill to his own cabinet. "If there's going to be a war, and who can say there is not, we must keep him fresh to be our war prime minister." Baldwin's tone was jocular and patronizing, yet there proved to be something in what he said. In May 1940, only generals and admirals knew the extent of Churchill's responsibility for Britain's ill-starred Scandinavian deployments. Nonetheless, the familiar view that he was the sole architect of disaster seems overstated. Had British troops been better trained, motivated, and led, they would have made a better showing against Hitler's forces, which repeatedly worsted them in Norway while often inferior in numbers. The British Army's failure reflected decades of neglect, together with institutional weaknesses, which would influence the fortunes of British arms through the years which followed. These were symbolically attested to by a colonel who noticed among officers' baggage being landed at Namsos on the central Norwegian coast several fishing rods and many sporting guns. No German officer would have gone to war with such frivolous accoutrements.